ena mana ena rea rara tangi rangatira ma. Nakutararo, nautararo, ka ora ai te iwi. With my basket and with your basket, the people's lives will prosper. Kia ora everyone, and welcome here tonight for our 2015 Macaulay Oration. My name is Richard Blakey. I have the great privilege to be the Deputy Vice Chancellor for Research and Enterprise at the University of Otago. I was going to say here at the University of Otago, but in fact we're not at the University of Otago. We're here in the Hutton Theatre of Otago Museum. So we are very proud to be members of the Otago community, and in fact in this unique place that we have where our museum, our university, our polytech and our wonderful sports precinct are so well coordinated and organised together. My job is just to welcome you here tonight on behalf of the university, and just to say a few words about the Macaulay Oration, and then I'll hand over to Professor Philip Hill, who will introduce our speaker tonight, Professor Sharon Peacock. We have, through the University of Otago, a number of connected research activities, and one is our Otago International Health Research Network that is currently hosting its eighth international meeting here in Dunedin. And we very strongly encourage both research interaction and engagement, but also public interaction and engagement with all of our research activities. And so this particular research theme and activity has taken that on board, and every year they hold an oration, a public oration. Now, the two of the key leaders in this, Philip Hill and John Crump, who are both with us, have their positions supported with endowed chairs. One is the Macaulay Chair and one is the McKinley Chair. So every year the oration changes from one to the other. So this will be the fourth Macaulay Oration, and there will have been already four McKinley Orations. And Macaulay Oration is named after Catherine Macaulay, who's a figure who's quite prominent in the establishment of Mercy Hospital in Dunedin. And it's through Mercy Hospital that the Macaulay name is able to be used for both one of our endowed chairs and also for this oration. Catherine was born in Dublin in 1778 to an upper middle class Catholic family, with a father who had a great concern for the poor but died when she was 5 years old. And a mother who, it is said, is not a particularly good manager of the family estate and died herself when Catherine was only 20 years old. But through her life, Catherine developed great philanthropy and also shared concern for her peoples and her communities. And she founded the Sisters of Mercy, established for the visitation of the sick poor and the protection and instruction of poor families. And it's through that that is the connection to our Mercy Hospital here that then enables us to be able to have this as the fourth University of Otago and Otago International Health Research Network Macaulay Oration. So with that brief introduction and by way of some words of the background to the name, I'll hand over to Professor Philip Hill to introduce our speaker for tonight. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Blakely. It's my pleasure to introduce you to our speaker tonight. Professor Sharon Peacock is a global leader in infectious diseases and has recently become the foundation director of the new Bloomsbury Research Institute, which is a partnership between the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine and the University College London. The new institute brings together more than 200 scientists dedicated to addressing the global challenge of infectious diseases. Prof. Peacock originally trained in medicine, after nursing training in fact, and specialised in infectious diseases and microbiology. She gained her PhD in 2003 for work on staphylococcal pathogenesis, which was conducted at the University of Oxford and Trinity College, Dublin. She then won a Wellcome Trust Intermediate Fellowship in Clinical Tropical Medicine and spent 6 years at the Wellcome Trust Major Overseas Program in Thailand from 2003. She then became Head of Microbiology at that unit. She later returned to the UK in 2009 to a chair in Clinical Microbiology at the University of Cambridge. and she developed a research program which focused on the translation of sequence-based technologies in diagnostic and public health microbiology. Prof. Peacock plays a number of important roles in the UK. She's an honorary faculty member at the Wellcome Trust Sanger Institute and is deputy chair of the Medical Research Council Infection and Immunity Board. She's made important contributions to the UK Chief Medical Officer's reports on antimicrobial resistance and has chaired the Working Group on Scientific Priorities for the Infectious Diseases Component of the Department of Health 100,000 Genome Project. A characteristic of Prof. Peacock's group's research, which I noticed very strongly when I was with that group last year on sabbatical, is that it's an intensely practically focused and is directly relevant to health, while at the same time being leading edge, multidisciplinary, and published in the very best journals. And the group have now published over 300 publications. A key focus that they have is on the use of microbial whole genome sequencing in diagnostic and public health microbiology, and its application to outbreak investigation and antimicrobial prescribing. Prof. Peacock is also undertaking a series of genomic studies to identify reservoirs of antimicrobial resistance in healthcare facilities, farms, the food chain, and the environment. Prof. Peacock's group receives funding from the Medical Research Council through a large translational infection research initiative consortium grant, from the Department of Health and Wellcome Trust through a Health Innovation Challenge Fund Award, among other funders. She continues to collaborate on research in lower and middle income countries, especially in Asia. Prof. Peacock is a fellow of the Academy of Medical Sciences and was awarded a CBE for services to medical microbiology in 2015. We're delighted, Sharon, that you just accepted our invitation to come to New Zealand to give them a call the oration, and also to stay for a longer period on the William Evans Fellowship. And I'd like to invite you now to come forward and deliver the 2015 Macaulay Oration.
Well, thank you very much, Philip. All I can say is, where did the years go? When you hear about your life described like that, you suddenly realise that a lot of water has passed under the bridge, but hopefully some very enjoyable and successful water it has been too. So I'd just like to say how delighted I am to be here today. I've been in New Zealand now for about a week and a half, and the hospitality I've been shown has been absolutely extraordinary, and the scenery I've seen has been quite breathtaking. And so there's no doubt, Philip, that I will be back, as they say, as Arnold Schwarzenegger would say. So it's a deep honour to give this oration, and my aim really in the next hour is to really describe the critical situation we have reached in relation to antimicrobial resistance. Now, I want to describe how we reached this point and to consider how genomic technologies can address the fundamental scientific questions, as well as how we can, if this can be used in a clinical setting to detect, contain, and control the problem. So for the purposes of the next 45 minutes, I'm really going to focus on bacteria, but there's a problem of resistance in viruses, fungi, and parasites, and that's no less important. I just don't have time to cover everything. So there's no way of starting a discussion about antibiotics without mentioning Alexander Fleming. Now, he's credited for the observation that bacterial growth on an agar plate was inhibited by a mold called penicillium. So you'll see here a bacterial plate with a bacteria Staph aureus growing on it with a zone of inhibition around this mold. Now, actually, what the history books don't often tell you is that he was not the first person to observe this. It's often the case when you dig back in history that many other people have been involved in such discoveries, and I've just mentioned some people here, including this gentleman who was a third-year PhD student when he described this phenomenon but wasn't able to take it forward. Now, we all know from the history books that Alexander Fleming recognised the importance of his observation but could not take it forward into clinical practice. And this relied on Florian Chain, shown down here, who were able to scale up production of the mold juice and put it into production so that by the time of the Second World War, we're able to use it for people on the battlefield when infection would often be a major cause of death if injury was not the cause of death. So that period really was followed by a heyday of antibiotic drug discovery. We discovered numerous drug classes, each having a different bacterial target. They're listed there. And what you'll see here, though, is that although we have antibiotics introduced down here, and a nice long list, along here what you'll notice is that antibiotic resistance was identified very close to the time when the antibiotic came into use. Now, more worrying still is that the drug pipeline for tomorrow's antibiotics looks very grim. This graph shows the data for the number of new drugs approved by the FDA, that's the approval body in the US for new drugs, between 1983 and 2012. And you don't need me to tell you what that graph is telling you. Now, there's been a lot of breastbeating about why we've got to this position where there's so much resistance, but we've got so few new drugs. Actually, the answers to that are really quite simple to formulate. First of all, research and development for any drug is lengthy, risky, and costly. So you'll see here the drug pipeline, and it will take around 15 years for a drug to get from first identification right the way through to screening. It's an expensive and lengthy process. You might say, well, actually, this is the same for any drug, so why are we failing on antibiotics when we're not failing on cancer drugs and other things? Well, there are several compelling reasons for this, and we need to understand this in order to reverse the problem. The first is that the technical hurdles for antibiotics is now very high. We've got all the easy wins. We know how to pick off bits of the bacteria that is essential to life, and so we can kill them. We've got those nailed. So the technical hurdles are much higher now for new antibiotics. Now, antibiotics work very well if the bug is susceptible. But they're only used for short periods. Now, if I'm a pharmaceutical company and I can market a diabetic drug or a hypertensive drug and someone takes it for the rest of their life, it's much better for my returns, my profit, if I do that rather than an antibiotic which is only needed for a week or 2 weeks. The other thing is that antibiotics do have a limited lifespan because once we start to use them, you get resistance emerging. There are also complications in terms of clinical trials for antibiotics. They're difficult to do. And I won't go into detail, but that is one issue that is another hurdle. The bottom line is that profit margins are low and the confidence in ability to recoup the cost is low for antibiotics. What does this mean? It means that most of the players have moved out of this discovery market. So you'll see here in this chart a progression of the attrition, actually, of companies falling out of drug discovery. So the state that we're in at the moment, in fact, a couple of those companies have since merged, is that very few big pharmaceutical companies are investing in antibiotic discovery. So where are we at the moment? What's the situation at the moment? Well, a comprehensive report that captures this very clearly was published by the World Health Organization in 2014. Now, they looked at just 7 common bacteria that cause disease from bloodstream infections through to gonorrhea. And they mapped rates of resistance to these around the world. Now, here are some of the results. So you'll see some of the organisms here, which you may recognize, E. coli, which causes urinary tract infections and bloodstream infections, and so on. You can see these 7 down here. And then what's listed is the drugs that are commonly used to treat these types of infections. Now, they looked at rates of resistance around the world, and there's quite a large range. The question is, what does it mean to patients? Well, this is what it means. So if you look at this column here, for deaths, for people that have infected with a resistant organism compared with something that is not resistant to that particular antibiotic, they have about 2 times the risk of dying. So it's very clear that patients infected with resistant strains die more. Now, the impact of antimicrobial resistance was also considered in health and economic terms by Jim O'Neill. So he retired as the chairman of Goldman Sachs Asset Management in 2013. And he's best known for actually coining the term BRIC, which is describes rapidly developing countries that are really shifting the global economic power away from the developing G7 economies. Now, he was appointed by the Prime Minister in the United Kingdom, and he employed RAND Europe and auditors, KPMG, very, very respectable organisations, to try and forecast the future if we don't do anything about resistance. Now, their report has been really instrumental and quite scary. They predict, in this chart, that antimicrobial resistance will cause 10 million deaths per year by 2050. So if you look at this here, you see the inner circle is where we are at the moment, and this outer circle is where we'll be in 2050. What you'll see is, if you compare it to cancer, antimicrobial resistant infections will be way ahead of cancer. Now, they also looked at this in relation to economics. And what they forecast was that if we do nothing, the world will lose a GDP of $100 trillion by 2050. So that's effectively loss of GDP in the UK every year for the next 35 years. Now, some people have looked at these figures and they think the evidence base on which this is based is too flimsy to be this categoric. But what it has done is it's actually brought people to start to think that action must be taken. So people around the world are sitting up and taking notice. Now, you won't be very surprised to find that there's inequality in the impact on death from antimicrobial resistance by 2050. So this is again a report from a page from Jim O'Neill's report, and you'll see that the size of the circle relates to the number of deaths that will occur. Most of the deaths will fall in Asia and in Africa. And there are some figures that have been produced by his group. For example, 1 in 4 deaths in Nigeria by 2050 will be due to antimicrobial resistant organisms. So this is something that we must sit up and take notice and do something about. Now, in a country like New Zealand, who's going to be affected once antimicrobial resistance really gets to grips? Well, the fact is, all of us. It will affect people throughout their life stages, from infancy to old age. It will affect our livestock and our pets. And this is something you might not have thought about, but actually, if we don't have effective antibiotics, you can't have cancer chemotherapy, because that makes people very immunocompromised, and they're often at risk of infection. If you can't treat that, then you can't have cancer chemotherapy. For example, joint replacement, very, very common. You get antibiotics before the surgeon makes the first incision. That would mean that if we don't have effective antibiotics, things like routine joint operations are going to be much more risky. Okay, so having set that rather apocalyptic scene, what I'd like to do now is to turn my attention to the advent and utility of genomic technologies. Now, a discussion about genomic technologies is really about the legacy developed by Fred Sanger. He played a really central role in the development of sequencing technology. So he was a double Nobel Prize winner. Very few people on the planet achieve even one, let alone two. And in 1977, he was awarded a Nobel Prize for, it was earlier than that, wasn't it? You can see on that, 1955. He determined the complete amino acid sequence of insulin. And what that did was really underpin the discovery of how DNA was actually structured. So his work underpinned the work by Crick and colleagues. He then went on to develop something called the dideoxy method for sequencing DNA molecules here. And he then sequenced a genome of a phage, an infecting virus that infects bacteria. So he was awarded 2 Nobel Prizes for that. Now, his method was actually very labor-intensive, and it became automated by the Applied Biosciences to create this first sequencing machine. Now, some of the people in the room might remember using these, in fact, might still even use them. This is a capillary sequencer, first used or automated in 1987. And I won't go into the technology, but essentially the output is a chromatogram, a coloured chromatogram, where each colour represents one base in the DNA. Now, this is, despite its labour intensiveness, this was used for the first human genome sequence in 2001. Now, since then, the pace of change in sequencing technology is really nothing short of absolutely extraordinary. So you can see here that back in 2000, let's just focus on bacteria, which are about 4 million base pairs. In the year 2001, it would cost me £500,000 to sequence one genome, and it would take 18 months. Now, in 2014, and in fact the figures are even better than this now, it would cost me £50, and it would take me 2 days. So the technology is really nothing short of staggering. So my next few slides really describe the broad approaches that can be taken in microbial sequencing to study antimicrobial resistance. Now, in the early years of sequencing, this was used to generate whole genomes of single bacteria, and actually that was used for numerous bacteria. So this really defined the entire genomic repertoire of a given strain, including drug-resistant elements. So, for example, this image is actually an MRSA, methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, which contains an element encoding a methicillin, which is shown here. Can't see that clearly. We learnt a lot by doing that, but in the last 5 years, the big change is that we've been able to scale up the number of genomes we can sequence. So we can really start to look at genomes in population terms. Now, what we can do with this is really look at two things. We can look at the population phylogeny and evolution, that's of a population, based on something called the core genome. Now, the core genome is the genes that are present in all members of that species. And so you can start to look at the evolution of resistance. You can look at the carrier lineages for resistance, as well as the genes that encode it. We're also interested in the accessory genome. That's the bits of DNA that get brought into the bacterium and that often encode resistance. Now, if you have a look at this tree, I'm just going to walk you through this because I will show some more trees in the future. So if you're not familiar with these trees, I'll just briefly mention what we've done here. We've sequenced a collection of bacteria. We've pulled out of the genome the core genes that is conserved across the species. And we've mapped it to a reference genome, so literally just lined it up to see what's similar or different. And these differences here are based on what's called single nucleotide polymorphisms, or mutations, single mutations. And this gives us this figure here, and it shows us how related isolates are to each other. Now you can just see here in more detail that this is the reference genome here, a part of one, and this is how we tile up the output of sequencing machines, and then we spot single points that are different to our reference, which then forms one branch of a tree. So that just gives you some basic understanding of how we do these trees, if this isn't what you do normally. We're also interested, in the accessory genome. This is an alignment of a resistance transposed on a piece of DNA that's encoding vancomycin resistance in an organism called Enterococcus faecium. And we can just see the differences across this population in what that looks like, what genes it has, what genes it hasn't. We can also do something called metagenomics. Now, in my previous analyses, we simply look at genes and genomes from bacteria that are grown in lab culture, but we know that that's not how bacteria survive. They're around us, they're in populations, and not as single isolates, they're in very complex populations. So what we do here is we literally extract DNA from a complex material such as soil or feces, and then we can type based on two types of analyses. We can just sequence all of the DNA in there, and there's little fragments of lots of different pieces from different types of bacterial species. Or we can clone those fragments into something called a vector, and we can get that bacterium to express the phenotype. So, for example, the piece of DNA may be encoding resistance. So really what I'm trying to describe here is the genomic tools we have available now to start to study antimicrobial resistance. So, having done that, I'll now discuss the examples of how these are being applied. So the first question I want to really explore is, when did antimicrobial resistance begin and why? So to try and gain an understanding of this fundamental question is really quite essential to us to developing our ideas around prevention as well as predicting future trends. Now, if we look at the timeline of antibiotic discovery, I've already mentioned to you that pretty much as soon as we have a drug available, resistance emerges. This suggests that resistance is not a modern phenomenon and was present before the drug was developed for therapeutic use. So what I'd like to do is describe two studies that have been published that, that look at this problem. How old is resistance? So the first was an analysis of genetic material from the late Pleistocene permafrost sediments in Alaska. So what this investigators did was they drilled down to the permafrost, which hasn't actually thawed for 30,000 years. That's because it was covered by volcanic material. So they obtained that very securely. And the top view shows where they actually did the drilling here. And this bottom view really shows the core that they took and how they actually took pieces of this core to do sequencing. And this is, comes back to this metagenomics approach where they sequence the entire material. So what you'll see here is the animals that they detected, such as the mammoth and the bison. Now, what they found, actually, was that there was resistance to a host of modern antibiotics well before they were discovered. Penicillins, tetracyclines, vancomycin. And vancomycin is particularly noteworthy because this, this resistance has popped up in the 80s in a bacterium that causes infection in hospitals called Enterococcus faecium. So what they did was they took the sequence and of these very ancient, at least 30,000 years old, and they aligned it to modern sequences. And in fact, you can see that the samples that are from the soil are actually just labeled with numbers, and they're very, very related. They did some more work, actually. They looked to see if these genes that they discovered actually encoded something active. And they confirmed that the genes did encode something active. They encoded an enzyme. And they also showed, using 3D structure, using crystallography here, that superimposing the modern vancomycin resistance against the ancient one was that they were very, very similar. So resistance has been around for a very long time. Now, a second study undertook a microbiome and resistome analysis of bacteria on the skin, in the mouth and stool of the Yanomami American Amerindian village, which is a remote village that live here. Now, they, according to history, have never actually been in contact with modern world. They've never seen antibiotics. I think the estimate is at least 10,000 years. They haven't come into contact with the modern world. And this was the first time that they did contact the modern world. And what these investigators found was that despite the fact that they couldn't have possibly seen antibiotics before, they had 28 functional genes in their microbiota that conferred resistance. And this is some of the drugs, including some of the semi-synthetic and synthetic antibiotics. That means ones that are not naturally made, but ones that are artificially made. So resistance has been around for a very long time. So what I want to come on to now is briefly touch on antibiotics as selectors and accelerators of resistance. It's always around us. It's been there forever. But what are we doing to drive the problem? Now, I've been in a seminar, in an all-day seminar today, and people have referred to farmers and the use of antibiotics in farms. And this is just some of the evidence that's been quoted to link antibiotic use with farming. Now, animals receive antibiotics for three reasons. They can be treated because they're sick. They can be given antibiotics because they're growth promoters, i.e. they make the animal put on weight more quickly. They can also be used as prevention to try and prevent infection. So if you look at this chart here, this shows the millions of pounds sold of antibiotics over time in the US. And this bottom line is antibiotics sold to treat sick people. And the top line is antibiotics sold from meat and poultry production. So it's very obvious that we use a large amount of antibiotics in animal husbandry. Now, what happens if you take antibiotics away from farming? Well, in Denmark, they have done a series of studies, and they have very tight antibiotic control there. So in this figure here, what you'll see is the percentage of bacteria, this particular one is Enterococcus faecium, that are resistant to this antibiotic, avilamycin, which is very similar to one we use in clinical practice. Now, when they first started to monitor this in 1995, rates were very high. But then, as they withdrew avilamycin use, so did the resistance fall. So there's a direct result between driver and the amount of resistance. And I won't go into too much detail about the graph at the bottom, but this is about E. coli that encodes resistance to what's called extended spectrum beta-lactamase. So they're resistant to the common drugs we give people. And again, you'll see in pigs this time that as As the drugs, the ban of cephalosporins in 2010 bit, then resistance fell. Now, that's good evidence for a correlation. And what this has led to, for example, in the CDC report, is that really they put humans at the center of antimicrobial resistance, and they predict how resistance spreads from animals who get antibiotics, that breeds out drug-resistant bacteria that gets into meat in our food chain. It contaminates the environment. And patients who go into hospital who also have antibiotic resistance emerging during their treatment and going around in a cycle in the human population. I think we have to be slightly careful because life is never that simple. And what I haven't heard commonly say is that humans give resistance to animals. Now, what's the evidence for this? Well, there is one particular study, which I think is absolutely groundbreaking, actually, performed by colleagues in Cambridge. And what they looked at was something called Salmonella typhimurium, DT104. Now, this is an organism that is spread from that is thought to be spread from animals to humans, and it causes gastroenteritis. It's multi-drug resistant, which is why it's one important, and it's widely disseminated across the world. Now, the paradigm is that that this is spread from animals to humans, both through direct and foodborne transmission. Now, what Alison did here was she actually took 135 human isolates and 113 veterinary isolates from Scotland, and she compared them using whole genome sequencing. And what they found was really quite surprising. What this tree shows is as follows. So the red is human isolates from humans. The blue is isolates from animals. And there are several observations. The first is that the most deeply rooted, that's the ones down here, branches for isolates, are from humans. That means that this originated from humans and not from animals. You'll also observe that colours cluster together, so isolates from a single host tend to cluster together, rather than free mixing. And when she looked at the rate of animal to human or human to animal events, there were very few. So this actually is the first piece of evidence that it's not quite as simple as us saying that animals give us all the resistance and we simply have to stop antibiotic use in farming, although I would accept that it's an important point. What she also looked at was the presence of antimicrobial resistance determinants in the population. So some resistance genes, genes that encode resistance, were shared between the two populations you can see here. But a greater number of determinants were actually in human-derived isolates compared with animal-derived isolates. So antimicrobial resistance isn't just about farming. So my final section, really, is to go on to look at the use of microbial genomics in clinical practice. And in particular, I'm going to focus on outbreaks and surveillance. I'm going to focus on Staphylococcus aureus because actually, there's quite a lot of work done in this, but it could be used for pretty much anything. Now, in this room, about 40% of you will be carrying this organism. It's associated with a wide range of diseases, and but there's a problem with methicillin resistance. That's the antibiotic that tends to be used for Staph aureus. It's readily spread from person to person, and it can cause outbreaks in hospital. You will have heard about MRSA or MRSA in the newspapers. Outbreaks in hospital are often caused by a very specific clone or strain that's adapted to hospital environments. And current typing methods really lack the resolution to tell members of the same bacterial clone apart. Now, this particular piece of work is actually one of the very first by Simon Harris and colleagues in 2010 to start to sequence bacterial populations. And this is one of the most key papers in bacterial genomics actually in the literature still. It actually seems quite simple. He took 63 isolates of a lineage of Staph aureus, which he called sequence type 239. That's what the current typing method calls it. You can see the timescale there, 1982 to 2007, including 20 isolates from a single hospital over 7 months and from 15 countries and 5 continents. And it was very simple. He grew the bugs, he extracted the DNA, and he compared the genetic sequence. Now, this is the phylogenetic tree, and it's color-coded by continent. So what you'll see here is that despite the fact that by conventional typing methods they're all the same, there's a huge amount of discrimination, and that is very useful for clinicians. The other thing to note is that there's something called phylogeography going on here. So the colours cluster together. That means there's genomes are actually located in particular parts of the world. Now you see here this blown up, blue is Asia, and there are two reds there, which is from Europe. Well, how is that? We tracked those cases down, and in fact, they both had very strong Asian links. So what this showed for the very first time is we can use sequencing to track bacterial movement through continents, across continents, which is very powerful indeed. Now, this is for the genomic geeks. Hopefully there'll be some in the audience. One of the things we really need to think about is how fast are bacteria evolving? Because if I want to work out if an individual has spread MRSA to another individual, I need to know how quickly the bacterium is evolving so that I can tell whether, say, 20 mutations is important or 100 mutations is important between the two bacteria. So what's the speed of evolution? Actually, we can do this fairly straight in a straightforward way. Now, if you remember the tree that I showed you previously, what we do is simply look at the distance from the root to the tip of that tree versus year of sampling, and we end up with a graph like this. Now here, you have these isolates plotted out in a different way, distance from the root to the date of isolation. And then what you can do is two things. You can extrapolate to when that clone first emerged, and you can also work out the rate of mutation, how many single nucleotide polymorphisms per year. The answer is 7.5, unlike 42. I can't resist saying that. So what we then did, having done that proof of principle study, was to go on to look at how we could use this in the clinic. This was actually one of the first studies published in the literature using sequencing in clinical practice. We spotted an MRSA outbreak in our intensive care unit, neonatal intensive care unit, and it's really simple. We sequenced MRSA from 7 cases in the outbreak and 4 that we didn't think were part of the outbreak. And actually, the tree was beautiful. What we had was we had a cluster of isolates here, which demonstrated that we had an outbreak going on, confirmed that. And then we had our reference and non-related isolates up here. Yes, you can use sequencing to investigate outbreaks. We actually set ourselves a much more demanding task then, and that is to use sequencing in real time to see if we could interrupt an outbreak. And I think that more by luck than judgment, actually, we also revealed how we're completely unaware of the extent to which hospital outbreaks spill into the community. So what we did here was, again, we worked in a special care baby unit, and in this unit, babies are swabbed every week for MRSA. And at this point, our infection control doctor said, we have a problem because we have 3 cases of MRSA carriage all at the same time. What is going on? Now, they'd been scratching their head for about 6 months because they'd seen a trickle of MRSA cases coming through the unit, but never enough for an outbreak because there were gaps in the timeline here and here. So they didn't really ever think there was enough for an outbreak. So they knew that they had these babies with MRSA, but they didn't know much more than that. They didn't know whether they were related or not. So what we did was we took these isolates and we sequenced them. And here you've got a slightly different tree in that you've got this like target, like a darts board, and you can see from here the way it steps out relates to the number of mutations and the relatedness. Now, there were only 20 mutations that differentiated those 14 isolates, and so we were confidently able to say, you have an outbreak. And at that point, we knew that we had an issue. Now, what we then did was we wondered whether this could have extended any further. And I've called this the dark matter of an outbreak because we never actually had the ability to see this spreading into the community. So we went to our microlaboratory and we said we want all of the isolates from the freezer that have the same antibiotic resistance pattern as our outbreak strain. We got 19 isolates, we sequenced them, and actually 10 of them fitted our tree very nicely indeed. They were related to the outbreak. But so we got their notes out and found that they were people living in the community, and nearly all of them had disease. They had skin or soft tissue infection. They had infection of the breast during breastfeeding. So we wondered how they might link up. Now, looking at the notes, it became very obvious how they linked up. So here, they're color-coded on the tree. So here, we find that a baby and a mother shared the same strain. That here, a family shared the same strain. We find here that actually mothers have been spreading MRSA on the maternity ward. None of this was known through conventional infection control. If we were sequencing these isolates on a regular basis, in fact, even right back here, we could have nipped this in the bud. Now, the interesting thing about this story is everything went away for 64 days and everyone breathed a sigh of relief until this infant was admitted and had MRSA. We sequenced it and it was actually on the genetic tree just here, part of the outbreak. They think, well, that's very odd. Where has that come from? We thought that the only answer could be a member of staff. So we swapped 150 members of staff that work in the unit, and we found an individual that was carrying MRSA. Now this time we actually sequenced 20 separate colonies from their nasal swab. And what we found was that it was right here. This baby was clearly implicated with this healthcare worker. We decolonized that person successfully. They went back to work and the outbreak was over. I have one last outbreak story to tell you. And this is really to try to work out who gave what to whom. Now, we can see how things are associated with outbreaks. But we want to know who gave what to whom, because actually, we need to control the situation. So this time, it's in a veterinary hospital in Cambridge. So this Alsatian came in with a severe skin infection caused by a different pathogen, Pasteurella. On day 5, the animal got worse, and MRSA was isolated from their wound at that time. They died on day 11, and a post-mortem was done. And they swabbed the animal from numerous sources in their body and started swabbing of staff and other animals. So here's the veterinary hospital. And in fact, they swabbed 97 staff and 158 animals over 71 days. Now, 7 staff were positive and 3 more animals became positive. And what they did this time was, instead of just picking one colony off the agar plate to sequence, they picked 20. Now, this reveals a level of complexity that clinicians in the audience might feel quite uncomfortable about, because it means that sequencing in clinical practice is not straightforward. What you'll see here is that you have along here, each row is a member of staff, and you have your index dog, and another 3 dogs were found to be positive over the swabbing period. Now, here you've got a circle to show the number of colonies that are in this particular lineage. The colours relate to the clade, so actually 3 of them belong to this something called sequence type 22, the same clone, but they were actually different clades. So they're colour-coded in red, blue, and light blue. I think that some of the things that really surprised us, or one of the things, is that people don't carry one strain. They carry multiple strains. And so if we just picked a single colony from, say, staff A, if we picked a blue, we'd think they had carried the blue lineage, but in fact they carried 2 lineages. The same was true for another member of staff here and the dog. So we also have to worry about how many strains people are carrying. Now, I won't go through this in any detail, but from that data, we were able to infer the transmission pathways from the sequence amongst those animals. And you can see the direction. It's incredibly complicated. So, for example, staff member F gave their MRSA to staff member A to index the index dog, and another staff member, probably to another member of staff G. So these patterns, it's not straightforward. So infection control isn't just a straightforward pattern of A to B. So finally, how can we use this on a national scale? What we decided to do was look at the MRSA population in the UK over a decade. And we took this number of isolates, 780 isolates. They were from all over the country, actually, highly representative sampling from across the country. And it was this single lineage, which we call MRSA 15. This is the thing that we get in our hospitals in the UK. Now, sequencing alone gives you this hairy comet. It's got most of the isolates up here with this tail here, which is absolutely meaningless. I have no idea what I could do with that. So somebody, one of my colleagues, came up with a very neat idea that we actually start to section up the country into what he called referral networks. What he means by that is, if you take a single referral network, say that one that I'm pointing to there, 80% of all patients go to hospitals within that referral network, and a small proportion go to the next referral network. What we were then able to do was actually colour code that hairy comet head by the region. So what you can see here, if I can get my pointer to work, is that actually there's some very clear clusters based on geography. What that means is that the country looks like this for MRSA lineages. And this forms the basis for surveillance of MRSA spread between hospitals and actually even within hospitals. It forms a really key contextual database. And in fact, in the seminar I heard earlier today, people were talking about the importance of contextual genomic databases. So this is what the power of large-scale sequencing can do. Now, this is a tree of all of those isolates that I've just shown you from the UK. But what I've done is I've put isolates in from both of those outbreaks that I just mentioned to you. And so you can see immediately how useful this contextual outbreak is. It wouldn't take a lot to say there's an outbreak going on there, and that's why these databases are so incredibly useful. So I'd like to conclude by saying that genomics is going to bring a massive revolution to the way that we understand and control antibiotic resistance. There are other things out there that we need to worry about. For example, this is the proportion of carbapenem-resistant Klebsiella pneumoniae. That's a gram-negative pathogen carrying something that makes the organism almost untreatable, actually. And the red is the danger areas, if you like, coming up in Europe. I'm sure that you will have, you may well have maps. Well, hopefully you won't have maps like this, but in Europe we have major problems. And so we have to deal with this, and genomics can help us go forward. So hope for the future. Well, I think that genomics will be important in infection control and in surveillance. I haven't talked about rapid diagnostics, fundamental science and so on, but I do think that genomics will have an important part to play in the control of antibiotic resistance in the future. So I'd like to thank you very much for listening and to thank my fantastic research group. We're celebrating at a Christmas party, and also my funders at the bottom. And I'd welcome any questions from you. Thank you.
Thank you, Sharon, for a wonderful talk. Sharon's offered to take some questions, so we'll start. If you could shout so I don't have to run over with the mic, that would be great.
Thanks a lot for that interesting talk. That last series of maps that you showed, you mentioned that those were representative samples, whereas in some of the other data you presented, it's possible that you may not get a representative sample from the population.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I think that's such an important, absolutely such an important point that you've raised. I think that there's two ways we can tackle it. You're absolutely right, and I mean, what this refers to is selection bias. And so, if you cherry pick the isolates that you really like, interested in sequencing, you won't get a true representation. And I think there's two ways that we can deal with this. One is that there are big initiatives going on to get representative sampling without selection bias for all of the major bacterial pathogens. And that's got to be shared. Open access, I haven't mentioned open access, but it's one of my hobby horses. We have to have open access. So in a project that we're doing at the moment, we're sequencing 10,000 genomes, bacterial genomes. But that is trivial compared to the massive efforts going on. I mean, hundreds of thousands. So we will get good representation. The other thing that we can do is work at the other end and say, if we can capture all of the data that's generated by reference laboratories, by regional hospitals that are doing sequencing. The real trick these days, I think, is to collect that data in a cloud-based or other-based and actually start to make sense of it in real time. And so in the end, the selection bias will wash out. There's always going to be selection bias if you sequence for clinical reasons. I think that these will form the baseline, but over time, we will actually move away from a reference lab who says, just send us something if it's got X, like carbapenem resistance. Because regional hospitals will sequence for different reasons to reference labs. But you're absolutely right, selection bias is a problem. But I think that is recognised, actually, as a real issue. Because yeah, you have to have unselected collections. But thank you for that question.
James.
Down to how you see that's getting into sort of the routine where that rest of the work is being pictured of particular police station outlets. And you find it makes it seem to be aggressive.
Yes.
How do you see that?
Yeah. I think within a couple of years, it's going to become very, very easy to put some bacterial species into context. And so I know of several groups who are developing automated interpretation tools. And so you'll need to run your sequencer, get your sequence data, and then put your sequence data into the tool. And that will automate confirmation of the species, confirmation of the resistance pattern, and then give you some basic data on genotype, and will then actually draw a tree to the most related isolates, to the ones you've got. Now, if you're in a hospital, you'll need to build up your own context to make that worthwhile. But I think that that's probably 1 or 2 years away. It's not available at the moment, but I do know people who are developing that. And that's the absolute bottleneck, in my view. Because if you sequence in the context of a hospital, you haven't got to worry about ethics. You work within a firewall of treating patients. It just becomes another diagnostic test. People worry about shooting up into the cloud, you know, data, but you do it within your own hospital. So I think the single bottleneck is informatics interpretation, but it will come. And what people are working on is that the report looks very much like a report you would see as a working clinician. It's been derived in a different way, but you get the added value of this strain is highly related to a strain in the patient in the bed, sort of, you know, highly related to another strain, and you can then go along as an infection control doctor and make the connection. The other thing I would say, and it's not work that I've shown here, is that our conventional view of infection control has to change, because with enterococci, for example, we're seeing outbreaks across specialities, across wards, which we'd never see necessarily within a standard epidemiology, you know, shoe leather epidemiology. But I've sort of got off the point a little bit, but we will see interpretation software coming along. And I'm very hopeful that it will be open access, because we don't want to be locked in to somebody who charges a lot of money for it. What should you be sequencing? I think that you've got to have somebody who can interpret things, obviously. I think that the answer is different for reference labs versus clinical laboratories. I mean, I saw a fantastic talk this morning by Debbie Williamson, and they were sequencing things related to outbreaks, which I think is absolutely right. In hospitals, if you haven't got the informatic tools to do the interpretation, it's difficult to start now. But once you have, I think you'll be looking for the same sorts of things. You'll be looking to spot transmission events, so infection control, that'd be key. Outbreak investigations in the community, but also ultimately predicting drug resistance. But the organism has to be a slow grower compared to phenotypic tests, which are still cheap as chips and easy to do. So TB is the exception to that, by the way. But that we can have a longer conversation, and I suspect we will, about clinical practice.
Any other questions? Yes, thank you.
I absolutely agree. I mean, I heard your talk this morning, which I like very much, and you know, I like the idea of you know, the New Zealand being sort of, you know, the green country where you can actually have very low rates of resistance. And if you want to control what resistance you have got, I think that working on that to look at isolates. And in fact, we've just done something like this in the UK, where we took isolates from we've done E. coli and enterococci from farms and from wastewater, actually, and from humans in hospitals. And that would actually show you, because, I mean, there's two things. The carrier lineages, are they the same across the species? And the resistance plasmids, are they the same? And that would prove definitively whether, you know, one practice needs to change. But I think there's a tendency to say it's all the farmer's fault, they're all to blame. I actually don't think that's necessarily true. And we've just finished a study in Cambridge, or east of England, where the lineages of E. coli in farm animals and in humans are completely different, actually. There's no overlap. So I think that we shouldn't be like sheep, as it were, following on with everyone else's view, saying it must be the farmers. We have to get the evidence, and this is the opportunity to do it. So I think that New Zealand would be a very good place to do this. And it, I can just see the grant application now, actually. I think it would make for very good reading. It would bring a smile to my face. So perhaps if you're interested, we could talk about that later. But I think that's a very good point, and important for New Zealand, actually. The economy here, etc.
Thank you very much. I'd just like to thank those of you who've come today to hear the oration, especially those from the public and from a wide range of parts of the public. And I'd like to thank again Sharon for her talk, and we'd just like to give you something uniquely from New Zealand, and I'll ask Prof Blakey to give that to you.
Thank you very much for the stimulating talk, and I think this is something that can bring for its mind.
Thank you so much. Thank you everybody for listening.
Thank you.